Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll be joined by Su T. Wong, one of the very few scientists who are studying sun bears. Sun bears are the smallest of the bear species and also the least known. We'll talk about the interesting characteristics of this rare Southeast Asian bear, threats to the species, and what people can do to help. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call is from a mammal that lives in the dense lowland forests of Southeast Asia. Now listen carefully and see if you can guess today's creature call. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again, tell you what kind of animal made them, and also give you a preview of next week's creature call. Now, let me turn to my conversation with Su T. Wong. For the last 13 years, Wong has been studying and working on the ecological conservation of the sun bear. As the least known bear species in the world, the sun bear from Southeast Asia receives very little conservation attention. They have been so long neglected that Wong refers to them as the forgotten bear species. Su T. Wong is one of the few Malaysian wildlife biologists trained in a Western country. He did both his Bachelor of Science and Master of Science at the University of Montana in Missoula and is continuing for his doctorate degree there. His pioneering studies of sun bear ecology in the Borneo rainforest revealed the elusive life history of the sun bear in the dense jungle. Wong's research has taken him to the most threatened wildlife habitat on Earth, where fieldwork is exceedingly difficult. While rapid habitat destruction from unsustainable logging practices, the conversion of the sun bear's habitat into palm oil plantations, and uncontrolled poaching activities paint a bleak picture for the future of the sun bear, Wong is determined to help the present situation of sun bears in Southeast Asia. Wong is the CEO of Bornean Sun Bear Conservation Center in Sabah, Malaysian Borneo, which he founded in 2008. Wong was also a fellow of the Flying Elephants Foundation, which awards individuals from a broad range of disciplines in the arts and sciences who have demonstrated singular creativity, passion, integrity, and leadership, and whose work inspires a reverence for the natural world. Wong is also the former co-chair of the Sun Bear Expert Team under the IUCN Species Survival Commission's Bear Specialist Group, and a current member of three IUCN Species Survival Commission Specialist Groups. When we spoke recently, I asked Wong how he first got interested in sun bears.
It was back in 1994 when I first came here to do my undergraduate study in Missoula, Montana, University of Montana. And then during the first semester, I was taking a class called Wildlife Conservation Issue. And then one of our guest speakers was Christopher Savine, who is an adjunct professor in our university. And at the time, he was talking about his research involvements on various bear species across the world. So I asked him at the end of the lecture, saying that I'm from Malaysia, we got sun bears, whether he has any projects working on sun bears or not. And he said, no, in fact, he's looking for a Malaysian student to do a study of sun bears. And at the time, he was the co-chair of the IUCN Bear Specialist Group. And at the time, back in 1994, no one had ever studied sun bear in the wild before. And he has been having this project, you know, to study an ecological study on sun bear for a long time. And by short, I think I showed up in the right time, the right place, meet the right people. And then he said, okay, why not? Yeah, we work together. And before that, I have experience working with radio telemetry in Taiwan. And also, I'm very interested in studying large mammals and so on. This is why I'm here. So yeah, so I met the right people, the right time, and the opportunity was given to me, and I take the challenge. And then after 3.5 years, I finished my undergraduate study and then get into the graduate program and start the first ever sun bear ecological study in Sabah as my master project.
And what was that project focused on? Just the general biology of the bears? Because not much was known about them, or virtually nothing was known. Is that right?
Yeah, Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So that study was pretty much a basic ecological study. What they eat in the wild, how much of a home range they need to use in the forest, and pretty much about it's pretty much about everything that I can get out of the radio collar animal. So I published 3 scientific papers out of that study. So we know a little bit more about what they eat in the forest, what they do in the forest, and also their relationship with the forest fruit productions and so on.
Tell me a little bit about the sun bears. What's special about them? You know, where do they live? Are they unusual because they're an arboreal bear?
Yes, well, it's very, very unique actually for me. I mean, everybody, when you ask questions to biologists or biologists, they'll tell you the species that they study is always a special, always unique, and they love them so much. So it would be the same for me. So okay, first, where is the sun bears found? Sun bears is found in Southeast Asia, ranging from 10 different countries, from eastern tip of India. So you have to look at a map of Southeast Asia, from eastern tip of India, southern tip of China in the Yunnan province, and then ranging south of that across Myanmar, Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, peninsula of Malaysia, islands of Sumatra, and islands of Borneo. So this is a tropical bear, so to speak. And they are the smallest of all the 8 living bear species. And then there are 2 different subspecies. The one in Asian mainland, Heractus malayanus. Malayanus is slightly bigger than the Bonin subspecies, the Heractus malayanus erysipelas. And then the Bonin subspecies, how small is small? The male weigh about 100 pounds. That's how big they are.
Before we get into more about their biology, how did you even go about studying them? Because they're hard to find, hard to see.
Yes. Yeah, so this is a very, the first challenge, okay? How am I going to catch them or put a radio collar, okay? To study a large mammal like a sun bear is, the first thing that people would do to study a large a mammal ecology is to put a radio collar on this animal, and then with this radio collar, we can follow them in the forest. We can try to get close to see what they do. We can collect their poops, and then we can know, how large their range is, and so on and so on. So the first thing is, of course, to try to catch them and put a radio collar on them. And then it is not easy. So we have tried to catch sun bears out of, without any kind of experience trapping a sun bear back in 1999. So at that time, I have some help from bear biologists from here. Tom Radon is a bear biologist working with Chris, and another person is Bruce McLellan, is a Canadian bear biologist, come to help me set up this trap site. We built traps out of wood. We built trap out of metals. Yeah, and we start doing the trapping.
And what did the traps look like? How big were they, and how did you bait them?
Okay, so there at the time we used 3 different kinds of traps. The first kind of trap is a wooden box trap, makes out of either lumber 3x3 and also made out of log. It is trap that was similar to the trap that they use here in North America to trap wolverine. So the trap would looks, very simple. It's a box trap, looks very natural, especially the lumber trap. And then there's another aluminum cover trap where we custom made in Montana out of aluminiums. And the beauty of this trap is that it can be taken apart into 9 pieces, and then we can backpack the whole traps into the forest and put it back together, so which is the beauty of it. And then the third kind of traps is a 55 gallons barrel traps. 2 barrel traps combined together and make it, a metal trap. So at a time, no one had ever trapped sun bears before, so I tried all different kind of bait, including, you name it, including all the fruits, honey. And then after months of trial and errors, and I figured it out, a best bait to trap sun bears, which is chicken guts.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it is cheap, it is smelly, and loves it. Yeah.
So they're not strictly herbivorous.
Oh, no. They are omnivorous. They are opportunistic feeders in the forest. And of course, you know, but in the kind of forest, you know, an animal has to be really good predator in order to be an effective predator. And some bears are bad. They are carnivore in design, but they end up eating all kind of food, whatever they can find. And fruits, of course, is one of the items that they can find in the forest. But if they can find carcasses, if they can hunt a prey, I'm sure that they would do that.
Was that known before you started studying what they eat?
Yes and no. Yes, from, you know, captive animals, we know that they are omnivores. They eat almost everything. And then in the zoo, the zookeepers has been giving them meat, you know, big cattle bones and stuff like that. So they love this kind of thing. And of course, you know, they are in other bear species also do the same thing. Say, for example, the sloth bear or the spectacle bear or the Indian bear, even though they eat a lot of plants material, but they also eat meat if there's an opportunity for them to have access of meat.
And do some bears kill prey, or are they more opportunistic in terms of just if they find a carcass or something?
Yeah, I think they are more opportunistic. And then if in the forest there are some prey item that is relatively easy to catch, then they'll definitely go for it. Say, for example, you know, what I found out is that they prey quite a bit on tortoises in the forest.
What kind of tortoises?
In Borneo, there is a species of tortoise called Burmese tortoise, which can grow into quite big size.
And yeah. And they can get at the tortoise with the shell.
Yeah. Apparently they could with their long claws, because this tortoise, when it is not a box tortoise, meaning that the shell did not seal up completely.
Oh,
you know.
Okay.
I think what the bears do. This tortoise only retract their head, their legs, and everything inside the shell. But still, there are some soft spot where the bears can easily put either their claws or their canine and do damages on the tortoise and eventually kill the tortoise.
How interesting!
Yeah. Yeah. Even though they have this armor, you know, they still can get hold of it.
And what else do the bears eat? You had mentioned they also eat insects, that you're doing some studies on special insects.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, sure. So in 1999 and 2000, during my first ecological study of sun bears, that time was the forest did not have any fruiting season. So the bears was pretty much feed on invertebrates, insects like many species of termites, invertebrates like beetles, beetle larvae, big time, earthworms, and all the insects, pretty much all the insects that they can get, like forest cockroaches, millipedes, and so on. And then but majority group of insects they feed on is termites, many species of termites, and also beetles, beetle larvae. So say, just now I mentioned about the tree-horned beetle or the Chalcosoma, which their larvae can grow as big as maybe 3 or 4 inches long.
Just oh, really?
Yeah, just packed with fat and proteins. And a bear can spend like an hour or two digging on a decay wood, try to fish out this big beetle larvae. And then, you know, the moment they fish one out, you can see from their eyes, from their facial express, it's like you had the best chocolate ever in your life.
So they still eat it even when there is fruit in the forest.
Well, yes. And then when there is, you know, the forest in Borneo do something, have a very special and unique features where the forest do not fruits annually.
Oh, really?
So the forest go through something called mass fruiting. And then the fruiting cycle is supra-annual, meaning multiple years. And then it became the mass fruitings occur from in the interval of 2 to 11 years. So during the non-fruiting years, the bears and a lot of the bears pretty much feed on invertebrates, and also there are few species of plants, of trees in the forest that do not follow the mass fruiting, and they are pretty much key on this kind of fruits. And some fruits like ficus is a non-mass species, and actually all of the animals, all of the fruit-eating animals in the forest feed on ficus, feed on ficus or the ficus.
Oh, really?
Yep.
And is there a lot of competition? I would assume there's a lot of competition for the ficus.
Yes, there's a lot of competition between, say, for example, the bears during the period where there are no fruits around. So from my study, you know, from all of the bears that I captured, especially the big male bears, they all have all different kind of scars, wounds from fightings. You can pretty much know that they have a tough life. You know, they compete each other because the food resources in the forest is so low. And then, but for the ficus, is something different because this big strangling fig is big and they can produce a big crop size, and there's actually no need to compete for this kind of fruits, and the resources is available for them in a period of, say, for example, 2 weeks or so, and one strangling fig can put out fruits up to 2 million fruits at one time.
One strangling fig can produce 2 million fruits? Wow.
So these strangling figs are big, you know, and then, they can produce 2 million fruits at one time. And then, so there's no need for competition, actually. I have evidence of like three different bears feeding on the same tree at the same time. Now, I've also witnessed one of my radio collar bears feeding on top of a fig trees, and then on the same fig trees, there was a female orangutan with babies. There was a binturong with babies, the gibbons, all kind of birds, squirrels, and everything, all come and feed on the same tree. Yeah, so it is a very spectacular sight, as you can see.
And is it seasonal or it's by year? So
okay, so fig tree is not seasonal. They fruit individually throughout the year. One tree may sometimes, depend on different species. Some species fruit like twice a year. Some put out three different crops in 1 year and so on. And the reason why the trees do it is because of the fig tree have to maintain a healthy relationship of healthy populations of fig wasps, which is their only pollinators. It's very, very interesting. These things can go on and on, talking about fig and fig wasp mutualism relationship.
Oh, interesting. And then what's the role of sun bears in the ecosystem?
Okay, well, obviously, I think sun bears do two big things in the forest. Well, actually, three. One is that sun bear is frugivores. They eat fruits, and they are large mammal, and then they eat fruits of big size fruits that has big seeds. Say, for example, durian, I'm not sure you have heard of it, is the king of the fruits in Southeast Asia. They eat fruits and they disperse their seeds. So sun bears is a very important seed dispersal in the forest ecosystems. And if you know the importance of seed dispersal in a forest ecosystem, is that they pretty much plant the forest. Okay, the trees of the forest produce fruits and produce seed, and the seed has to be carried away far from the mother tree in order to enhance the germination rate, the survival rate of the trees. And then sun bear, being a large fruit-eating animal that eat the fruits, eat the flesh, and carry the seed far away from the mother tree, is actually a very important seed dispersal in the forest. So sun bear is an important seed dispersal in the forest ecosystem. This is one.
What about its second role in the ecosystem?
It's something to do with feeding again. By feeding on invertebrates, insects, termites, say for example, they break this termite mound, they break apart decay wood to fish out beetle larvae and so on. So they are actually creating another type of niche and other types of feeding site for other animals once they break into, you know, the decay wood, they break into the termite mound, and actually they didn't finish everything. They leave another site for other animals to feed on. So they are also considered as ecosystem engineer. And also they feed on beehives. Some of the beehive is actually on tree cavities. And then they have to like break into this to the main trunk of the trees in order to get the beehive, and they create a tree cavities, and then these cavities will later on be used by, say, for example, flying squirrels to make nests, or hornbills to make nests, and so on. So they are forest ecosystems engineer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, of course, you know, they preyed on a lot on termites, so they are actually maintain a healthy forest, because termites, you know, have the bad reputations of killing the trees or infested trees, which is either healthy or less healthy, and then by reducing all these insects that may harm to the plants, they actually do the forest or do the plant community a good thing by eliminating or keep the populations of this harmful pests, you know, insect in a certain healthy level, so to speak.
They play really important roles in the ecosystem.
Yeah, the ecosystem is very complex, and everybody have certain important roles, you know.
What is the conservation status of sun bears? Are they endangered?
Okay, so yes, they are an endangered species. They are listed under the IUCN Red Book listings as vulnerable species, okay? They have this status in just 2008. And before that, sun bears is listed as IUCN as data deficient because there are so few people studying them and working on them, and we actually do not have the scientific informations to show how many sun bears are there in the wild. Until now, we don't have an estimate of how many sun bears are there in the wild. But looking at the big picture as a whole, say, you know, looking at the deforestation rates in Southeast Asia, and the forest is disappearing so fast, we know that the sun bears are in big troubles, and their populations, from this habitat destructions alone, we know that their population has been declined by more than 30% over the last 30 years of their original size. And then with all the poachings, all the huntings going on, and all the pet trades going on in these regions, and actually sun bears are in trouble. And even though I do not have the numbers or estimates numbers of how many sun bears are there, but from my experience working in the forests in Borneo, their numbers is lower than orangutan, that's for sure.
You hear so much more about orangutans.
Well, I see orangutans almost every day in the forest, you know, but I just don't see sun bears every day. I know they are elusive, but the thing is that, you know, I have been spending like almost 6 years in the forest, and yeah, orangutan is in my study area as long as the forest is healthy and is intact, but not sun bears.
What would it take to do a population census? Is it even possible?
Yes and no. It's until now, you know, I try to estimate the numbers of bears in the forest, and I pretty much fail because I do not have come up with a reliable method to do it. You know, right now in the wildlife research world, two methods that people use most is this method called cap and recapture. By assessing the probability of capture rate and then the recapture rate, we can come up with the formulas of how many animals are there in the wild. And this method has been widely used by tiger biologists, where individual tiger can be recognized from camera traps, and then the tiger can recapture by setting up camera traps to re-sight them again. But this method is not applicable to sun bears, because sun bears, you cannot identify individual from a camera trap picture because they are just black, you know, they don't have a special marking on it.
Okay.
So we cannot use this method unless the particular animals are marked with, say, radio collar or ear tags and so on.
So then what is the alternative method that researchers commonly use for population studies?
Another type of method people using is DNA. And so far, a bear's DNA in the wild is quite difficult to collect because the climatic conditions, you know, you're having in a tropical rainforest, say, for example, in Borneo, you know, it rains almost every day. The genetic materials of a wild bear is very difficult to obtain. So until now, no one had ever come up with a good method to assess the population. And also, there's so few people studying sun bears until now.
So how many people study sun bears?
At a time when I started my sun bear project back in 1998, there was actually 3 people, including myself, studying sun bears in Borneo. And then and it was me. I was working on my master at a time, and the other 2 researchers are pretty much working on their PhD. And then I continue after I finish my master programs and then start another field study back in 2005. Then last year, there was an additional 3 or 4 projects, 2 in Sumatra and 1 in Thailand and another one in Peninsula of Malaysia studying sun bears. So you're talking about, you know, after all these years, less than 10 people in the world have ever studied sun bear, period.
Wow.
Yeah, less than 10. Compared to other large mammal or other bear species, you know, the number is very, very low. And we are so way behind in terms of generating scientific information for sun bears.
So do all of you exchange information? What's a party like between you?
Yeah, sure. You know, this is something that I am working really hard and try to get everybody collaborate, try to exchange information as much as possible. And since, you know, I am one of the very few person in the world who first do this work, and I want to assist, you know, as many students or as many biologists as possible to do their work. I mean, I have spent a lot of time in the forest to learn about sun bears from the hard way, you know. So, and then if I can pass on my knowledge to others so that they don't have to learn from the hard way, so to speak, I would love to do that. Almost everybody have in close contact with me, and I try to give advices and my opinion, my comments as much as possible, or even help them to do their study.
And then what are some of the biggest threats to sun bears? You talked a little bit, or you mentioned the habitat destruction and the poaching and hunting and the pet trade. Could you describe some of those threats and which are the most important?
The threat that you mentioned, they all are threats, okay? But, you know, including the pet trades, including the poaching for the bear parts, including the habitat destructions, and by far, habitat destructions is the biggest threat for sun bear survival in Southeast Asia.
Why is that?
Sun bear is a forest-dependent species. They have to live in a forest, period. So when you see, you know, a country or landscape is being cleared, trees being chopped down, forests being cleared and replaced with plantations, replaced with developments, meaning that sun bear lost their habitat, lost their home forever. So this is one big threat. And then the deforestation rate in Southeast Asia is horrible. And with oil palm plantations slowly replacing the tropical rainforests in Southeast Asia, meaning that sun bear lost their homes. And you don't need to have a rocket science to prove that. How serious are they affected by the plantation, by the deforestation? So this is one threat. And then the second threat that I mentioned earlier is poaching for bear parts, which is still ongoing. And sun bear is still being poached for their parts, like gallbladder, like their claw, their canines, their meat, for many purposes, especially the traditional Asian medicine.
And then there's the pet trade.
Sun bears are really cute. They are super cute. This is the smallest of the bear species, and because they are cute, they are small, and people love to keep them as pets. And with the deforestations side by side, logging roads was built in the forest, extend into the forest interior, and baby bears invulnerable. You know, poachers poach the mother, capture the the baby, and the baby becomes a community in pet traits, and people keep bears as pets.
And do they make good pets, or do they grow up?
Absolutely not a good pets. Obviously, like all animals, they grow up, and they are bear, you know, with big claws and strong canine, and they are very destructive. No one can tame a bear, okay? And at the end, they were locked up in metal cages, which is very, very sad, and the situation is quite desperate.
Is that the reasoning behind founding? You've also helped found the Bornean Sun Bear Conservation Center?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that and how that came to be.
Yeah, I first was given the opportunity to study back in 1998. So at a time, you know, my interest on studying bears grow and studying this species, sun bears grow. And I noticed that there is a lot of sun bears being held in captivity, either in private owners keep a sun bear as pets, or all kind of, you know, crocodile farms, there's a mini zoo and private menageria and zoos and so on, they all have a lot of sun bears. And they all were very, very sad. In the wild, they roamed the forest, but they all were locked up in small cages, shake their head all day long with this very serious, stereotypic behaviors. So this is quite sad, and nobody tried to do anything about it. And sun bears is a protected species in all of the countries where they are found. So by law, nobody is allowed to hunt sun bears. By law, nobody is allowed to keep sun bears pets. By law, nobody is allowed to kill sun bears. But because of lack of law enforcement, because of the lack of interest to conserve the species, this kind of thing happened. Keeping the bears as pets, poaching, killing, they all happens.
Backing up for a minute, so the laws are, it's a protected species.
It is a protected species.
And you can't poach it. Can you keep it as a pet legally?
No, unless you obtain a special permit. So you have to imagine, you know, Southeast Asia is not like North America. Southeast Asia is a developing country where wildlife law is actually least priority compared to human, you know, criminals law. So at the end, most of the wildlife law are not well enforced. So people keep bears anyway because they will never get caught, you know. And sometimes even though the government's confiscated those animals and the government facilities to house those bear are equally bad. And then with the lack of interest from other well-known international NGOs to help sun bears, I was put into a position that, okay, fine, you guys don't want to do it, then I'll do it. And one of the first group of animals that I wanted to help is those cage animal. People has to be told by saying, no, you cannot do it. You cannot keep sun bears as pets. This is against the law, you know. And then those cage animal has to be rescued because they are like the moon bear being kept in very bad living condition. And this is the first thing that we have to do. So I founded Bornean Sun Bear Conservation Center. The first thing that we want to do is try to rescue all of these cage bear. And then the second thing that we want to do is to educate the people saying that, okay, this is a protected species, this is a unique species, and show them how special, how unique sun bears are, and what kind of important roles they put in the forest ecosystems. And of course, we want to do conservation work, and we want to try to rehabilitate those cage bear into the forest, and then we will continue to do our research work on sun bears.
When was it established?
I have this idea of setting up this, you know, since 2004. But it wasn't until 2008 that it finally, after I finished my, officially finished my field work. And I founded it in 2008, so 2 years now, and based in Sabah, Malaysian Borneo.
And how did you get funding for it?
Funding is very, very challenging. So these projects, I didn't do it myself. You know, it's impossible to do it all by myself. I actually are very fortunate to have the help from a local NGO from Sabah called LEAP, stand for Land Empowerment Animal and People. Sleep take this project as their own projects and help me establish it. And then we create partnership between the Sabah Wildlife Department and the Sabah Forestry Department. So these are the two government agencies that helps to establish this Bodin Sambil Conservation Center.
That's unusual to have a government agency in this.
Yes, very interesting because first of all, there's lack of interest behind this to set up this center by the government. Okay, so as a biologist, as a conservationist, we work together. We assist the governments to set up the center. Okay, the resources come from private entities and then collaborate with the governments because the bears actually belongs to the governments, to the country. Okay, we need to have the Sabah Wildlife Departments involved in this project in order to make this project successful. And then actually the land, eventually when we want to reintroduce the bears into the forest or even the forested land we are building our enclosures in for the Sun Bear Conservation Center, it actually belongs to the forestry departments. So it makes sense that forestry departments and wildlife departments are a partner on this project and we do this together.
What does the facility include and how many bears can it house?
Okay, can I backtrack a little bit?
Oh,
I haven't talked about the funding yet. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So the funding to set up the center is not cheap. We need about $1 million to set it up. Then because of we are private, I mean, we don't have any money to start with. We have to raise this money. So we dividing the whole constructions of the project into three different phases. And the phase one needs about $400,000. Actually, we have been fundraising from many zoos, many privates, and also corporates over the last few years, and to raise this fund. And then back in November of 2000, we did a fundraising dinner. It's a gala dinner that we raised close to $300,000 in one evening.
Wow.
Yeah, and that evening, the governments also declare a matching fund. So they will match one-to-one to whatever fund that we raise. So this project is actually half funded by the Sabah state governments.
Wow.
Yeah, and the first phase of the project just finished last month, which is the constructions of a bear house that can house 20 different bears in and also 1 hectare forest enclosure. And then if you go to my blog, I went back to Sabah to do the bear moving to this new facilities. And right now we are officially entered the phase two.
Tell me about phase two.
Phase two is involved refurbishments and upgraded of our old bear house and also a renovations of the offices. And then we'll have a visitor gallery for visitors who comes in, and we'll build boardwalks and observation board for people to visit and come to see bears in the forest and enclosure. So that is phase two, which needs about $30,000 to build. And one of the unique thing about our project is our location. Our location actually next to the well-known Sepilo Orangutan Rehabilitation Center, where each day there are hundreds of tourists come to see orangutan. And then we want to open our facilities to visitors as well, because we want to educate those people, the visitors, the tourists, about sun bears and let them come and see sun bears in their natural environments. And at the same time, we also can generate revenues from tickets to run our program, to run our conservation program, to run our education program, our rehabilitation program, and research program as well in the future.
I was going to ask you if you work with orangutan rehabilitation. Mm-hmm.
Yes, actually, we are side by side. The facilities is run and owned by the Sabah Wildlife Department, and my project, working on sun bears, is also a Sabah Wildlife Department project. So we share the same vet facilities, say, for example. And then we have actually the facilities before we take over was actually run and managed by the Sabah Wildlife Department. Those bears are actually confiscated by the Sabah Wildlife Departments and then put into these facilities. And later on, I step in, I take over, and manage those captive confiscated bears.
How many bears do you currently have in the facility?
We have 12 bears right now, and then right after our first bear house is built, we have another 4 bears will come in next week or 2 weeks from now, and then additional 10 bears are lining up to come in. So we fill up our capacity 1 month after we finish our first bear house. Yeah. So this will lead us to the phase 3, which is building another bear house and another forest enclosure. So as you can see, there are a lot of bears in captivity that need to be rescued, that need to taken care of. And then the same thing would be the same in other places, like in Sarawak, different states in Malaysian Borneo. And then same thing as well in Peninsula of Malaysia. Same thing as well in islands of Sumatra, in the Indonesian side of Borneo, the Kalimantan, and the rest of the Southeast Asia.
Do you have an idea of how many bears do need to be rescued?
Well, in Sabah, I have a brief idea. At least there are like, at least there's 50 bears or more need to be rescued right now. And I'm sure that there will be more in the future because with the forest clearing, yeah. So in Sabah, at least 50 and or even more. And then in Sarawak, there are hundreds. And in Kalimantan, hundreds to a thousand.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So different locations have their own problems.
Are there plans to release them into the wild? Or what would it take to release them?
Well, it takes a lot of time, a lot of resources, and a lot of manpower to release them. But I think it is the right thing to do. And sun bears, like other bears, I believe that they are rehabilitable. It's just that you need to spend a lot of resources, money, and efforts, and try to bring them back to the wild.
I had another episode of The Wildlife on orangutan rehabilitation, and it was very interesting because it was quite an extensive process, and really from beginning to release, which is happening, the first releases are just happening now after 10 years.
It is not easy. It is very, very time consuming. And what we plan to do is actually to select the bears that still has very strong instinct to do feeding in the wild, and still have a lot of instincts, have the behaviors and so on that a wild bear has. And then we have to like pretty much walk them in the forest every day. And this is a slow process. This is not a hard release. This is not, you know, bring the bear into a forest and open a cage and say, you know, yeah, good luck and have a good life. No, it's not going to be like that. It will be a very slow process where we have to live with the bears in the forest for years until they are strong enough to defend for themselves, until they are knowledgeable enough in the forest to know where food are in the forest, until they establish their home range in the site where we want to release them. So it takes time and a lot of resources, but this is the right thing to do.
So you're already identifying bears or not yet? Because you just started.
Yeah, we just started. And actually, okay. I have, you know, right after we move our bears to our new bear house and the forest enclosure, and we are actually right now studying individual animals to see who can make it, who will be the first candidate, who can be a potential candidate to be released into the wild.
I'd love to hear about some of the bears that you have rescued. I noticed on your website you had links to some very recent video of putting two males together because you'd already run out of room.
Yeah, sure.
So I'm just wondering about some stories of bears you've known.
Yeah, and then if you have seen the Bear Track promo, you know what is a Bear Track?
No.
Bear Track is an epic movie. It's a movie that was produced by Wildlife Media, a relatively new company based in Seattle, that they are doing a big screen movie about bear research in the world. And actually, you can Google or go to my YouTube channel to see the promo. In that movie, it shows I was trying to attempt to reintroduce baby bears, bear cubs into the wild. And then that cubs, that bear cubs is Chura. And she's with us right now. And yeah, so this is something that we want to do in the future. Chura is a good candidate. And another female bear is called Jalita. She might be a good candidate as well. And right now, we are closely working with another sub-adult female. Her name is Surya. And we are trying to establish this bonding with our keepers so that, you know, the bears can trust our keepers and the keeper will eventually walk the bear in the forest, hopefully by next year or so, when we try to reintroduce them into the wild. And then the video clips that you saw on my website about this Om and Achong, this two big male, it might and might not be them, you know, that we want to introduce. We have to observe how they perform in the forest enclosure first.
Interesting. And then what makes Chura, say, a good candidate?
Well, the instincts is a very crucial point. For a lot of these captive sun bears, where they have been, like, it's actually very sad. They have been kept in captivity in small cages or walking on cement floor for years, and they have been fed by, you know, all this human food, rice, fruits, and so on, until a point where they lost their instinct to recognize, say, for example, termites is their natural food, you know. So we have to identify those animals still have the instinct. Once you can see very clearly if an animal being introduced, being given an opportunity to feed on termites, say a decay wood with termite, they either pick it up right away, you know, start sniffing on this decay wood and start to break it and try to lick whatever they can find that come out from this termite nest, or they just leave it alone, because they, you know, those bears that lost their instinct pretty much forgot or do not associate that kind of natural food as their food. So this is bad candidates that we want to release. So instinct is very, very important. And bears are just like humans. They have different personalities. Some are smarter than others. Some are more alert than others. Some are more cautious than others. So we want to pick up the bears who are very alert, who are, you know, so on, quote unquote, very smart, and then who have a very strong instincts to forage in the wild and so on. On these kind of traits is actually important for their success.
And is there one bear in all your studies that has stood out to you? Just not necessarily for rehabilitation, but just in general, where you developed a particular bond with this bear?
Yes and no. So far, the 12 bears that we have in our center, we are still observing. Because we just moved to this new bear house with nice forest enclosure. We are studying individual behavior right now. So just now I mentioned, you know, Jalita, one female bear, is Surya, Chira, they all are candidates. And in the future, we hope, you know, to identify more bears that have this kind of traits to be released into the wild. And in the past, actually, I have released Bate, an adult female bear, into the wild as well.
You had mentioned the bear's expression when they would eat the beetle larvae, like like the yummiest of chocolate.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
What does a bear's happy expression look like?
well, first of all, they close their eyes. They, you know, they, they close their eyes, and I'm not sure you notice or not, actually bear smile, you know, they're like human, like dogs.
Oh,
they
really?
Smile. Yeah, they when they smile, they pull their facial muscle on the you know, backward, so it makes like they are smiling. And and this is one of the experiences. They close their eyes, and then they chew it, and you can know that it's just like human. You know, when you have when you are tasting a very nice piece of chocolate that you enjoy so much, you close your eyes, you let the chocolate melt into your mouth. That is exactly the same expression when they have this big, juicy, fatty, and packed with proteins, beetle larva in their mouth.
And have you tried the beetle larva?
No.
Just wondering if it was as good as advertised.
Yeah, I'm not that desperate yet. Maybe once I'm on the forest, I would do what the bears do in the forest and try to take out this beetle larva.
And then what can people do to help if they get interested in sun bears? What would you recommend that they do to help?
So,
and where can they go for more information?
Yes. Okay. So first of all, we have to understand that sun bear is the least known bear in the world. Okay. There are so many people, so many people heard about polar bear, heard about grizzly bear, heard about giant panda, but they never heard about sun bears. Okay. So by helping us spread the words of sun bears, by showing people pictures of sun bears, by putting stories about sun bears in their Facebook and so on, they help us to promote the awareness. And right now with Bonin Sun Bear Conservation Center, right now we have a platform to get people's help, for people to help us by promoting our work, by promoting this species in anywhere. You know, recently last week I have a teacher from Taiwan. He is doing a little fundraising and also awareness campaign for sun bears and help us to raise some fund for us. And of course, you know, for BSBCC, Bonin Sun Bear Conservation Center, all of our works needs money. Unfortunately, you know, all conservation works spend money. And the amount of money that we raise or we generate reflects the amount of work we can do to help a species. So we need funding so much. And then fundraising for an animal that is not well known is not easy. You know, it's not like orangutan, tigers, or elephant, or rhino, where everybody knows about it. So fundraise for this charismatic species is a lot easier than a little-known species. So we need people to donate for funding. And then, for BSBCC, we always need help to take care of our bears, and then try help us spread the words and so on. I think the model that we need for sun bear to help the species is actually very similar for other endangered species that needs a lot of people's involvement from different fields. We need to set up NGOs that specialize on sun bears, just for sun bear, just like all the NGOs working with tigers, with elephants, with orangutans, with rhino, and so on and so on. So it's the same model. We need more and more people care for this species. Yeah. And then at the same time, we need more people, I mean, more students or more biologists to study this animal. There's still a lot of unknown in the scientific world about this bear. So, and I was asked so many times, how can people help? My answer is, whatever you do best, you know, to help this bear. I have artists help us painting of sun bears, and we sell it during auctions to raise funds. So this kind of thing. We have had, you know, reporters report about our work write about sun bears. So this is something that people can help easily. And of course, you know, right now everybody's on Facebook, you know, just join our cause. We have a sun bear conservation Facebook cause. We have Twitter, so join us and get in touch with us. And if we need help, try to raise funds and things like that, you know, anybody can help us to do that.
That's great. Thank you so much for talking with me.
No problem. It's an honor.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about sun bears with Su Ti Wong, a Malaysian biologist and world expert on sun bears. Now let me play you today's creature call and see if you've guessed it correctly. This week's creature call is the sound of the smallest bear species which resides in Southeast Asia, and it was also the subject of today's show. That's right, it's the sound of a sun bear. Listen to this unusual vocalization. For next week's creature call, I'll play the sound from an ungulate that lives in the western United States. Here's your preview. Be sure to tune in next week when I'll replay this strange sound from the wild world and reveal the animal that made it.
Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show, or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com.
The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.